This is Attention Humans, the podcast of the University of Colorado Consortium for Climate Change and Health.
Each episode, we explore the human dimensions of climate change with some of the leading experts at the University of Colorado and beyond.
I'm Jake Fox.
I'm Cameron Nicewander. We're your hosts for the show.
It is our goal to help you, our listeners, learn about the health consequences of global warming.
And ask you to get involved in personal and political efforts to slow climate change.
As always, please check out our webpage, cuconsortium.org/podcast, for episode summaries, show notes, and our comment box.
Without further ado, on to the show.
And this long line of cars is all because of you.
Hey everyone, Jake here, and thanks for tuning in to part 2 of 3 of our Climate Science Primer. For this episode, we're going to reconvene with Dr. Chris Karnauskas. If you didn't hear his introduction in our first episode, Dr. Karnauskas is an atmospheric scientist up in Boulder, and he's a member of the University of Colorado Consortium for Climate Change and Health. Previously, he gave us an awesome overview of some of the basics of climate science, including what the greenhouse gas effect is and how we put together climate models. For this episode, we're going to delve a little bit deeper and talk about uncertainty and carbon dioxide. So without further ado, let's tune back in with Dr. Chris Karnauskas.
I think we mentioned earlier the IPCC report, and this is a question that I know I'm probably the most excited to talk about today, but we often hear this term uncertainty, scientific uncertainty. We kind of wanted you to help us unpack what that means. Are we uncertain that climate change is happening?
Right. I'm glad you asked that. That's a word that I actually spend several lectures in my own classes just talking about, because, you know, predictions without uncertainty, you could argue, are useless. You know, if you don't know how sure you are of a prediction, you know, you really, decision makers always want to know how sure you are, instead of just a number. So when it comes to, let's think about future climate predictions. How uncertain are we of those, and what are the, why are we uncertain? And does that mean that, you know, we're uncertain that climate change is even happening? So we have a few different sources of uncertainty about the future. You mentioned scientific uncertainty, and what that really refers to is the fact that, you know, we build these computer models of the climate system, and we don't know everything about how the climate system works yet. We probably never will. So we are doing the best we can with the laws of physics and as we know them right now. There's a lot of complicated things in the climate system, like clouds, aerosols. How do these have an effect on climate change? So what that means is all around the world, there are many climate modelers. There are many institutions that run climate models that then feed into the IPCC report results. What this means is that all of these different modeling centers are free to make their own choices about how to build their climate models. And this is actually a good thing. If we all built the exact same climate model, we're all going to get the same answer. And that would not give us a sense of uncertainty at all. So we have some uncertainty that's guaranteed to happen because a climate modeling center in France might use one segment of code and code something up one way and use one, you know, parameter or coefficient for, you know, mixing of waters in the deep ocean or something that seems really kind of
obtuse.
Yeah, obtuse. Yeah. You know, why would that have an effect? All these little things do have an effect. So we've got, you know, roughly 50 of these big state-of-the-art climate models around the world. You know, maybe 5 or 6 of them are run here in the U.S. NASA's got one. The National Center for Atmospheric Research here in Boulder has one. Different branches of NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, have some. And then all around the world, there's a bunch more. So we all run the same experiment, and that is what is great, because the difference between the model results mean they're because the different models are different, not because we're making different assumptions. Just imagine if we were all running different climate models and we never got together for a little powwow first and said, you know, in which we say, here are the experiments we should run. Here are the assumptions about CO2 we should all put into our climate models. So that's your scientific uncertainty. We have the same assumptions, the same carbon dioxide futures and everything, but we get different results. And that is a very important insight into how sure we can be. So that's your scientific uncertainty. As time goes on and we keep you know, observing the world, gathering data, doing studies of it, we might make those models better and perhaps even converge a little bit more. But for now, it's good to know how unsure we are because we have imperfect models. The other source of uncertainty, one of the other big ones, is we don't know what we're going to do in the future, right? We don't know if we're going to adopt the Paris Accord, the world adopts the Paris Accord, and we start drawing down CO2 emissions, you know, basically tomorrow night, and go negative emissions by mid-century. We might do that. We might also carry on our business as usual emissions that we're doing right now. And so that is its own source of uncertainty about future climate change. So we, of course, we run those different scenarios with the climate models and we compare them all to get those results that you see in the IPCC report. But it doesn't mean that we're not sure the world's going to warm. It really just means, like, are we talking about 2.5 or 3.5 degrees given a certain assumption about CO2 emissions.
So it's not like half these models say the Earth is going to warm, then the other half say it's going to cool down.
Exactly, okay. Right. And when we, you know, on the flip side of that, when we run our computer models for the time that has already passed, like say the last 150 years, this is a really important experiment because, you know, we have a pretty good estimate of how the Earth's temperature as an average has unfolded over that period of time. We also have a good estimate of how much CO2 we've emitted. So we can do that experiment and see if the models can, without knowing the answer, see if they can actually get the actual observed responsive temperature right. And they actually do a pretty good job of that. So we can even go a step further and do an alternative experiment where we don't include the CO2 change that we have been the cause of. And we see if the temperature still would have, just for some magical reason, gone up the way it did. And of course it didn't. So that's you know, getting back to one of your earlier questions, how do we know it's us? Well, we can run our computer models for the past with two different sort of scenarios, one where we exist and one where we don't exist. And we only get the warming happening the way it did in the real world if we assume we did exist and, in fact, emit all that CO2 over time.
Awesome.
Yeah, thank you for that overview. Are there other things in terms of climate science that you want to make sure our listeners are aware of?
I think one of the most important things for people to remember, regardless of their interest in, you know, knowing all the details of how climate models work or how we gather observational data from the real world, you know, we are certainly doing something that's unprecedented going back a really long time, like millions of years, in terms of the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, but also how fast it's rising. A really profound thing to look at is not just the amount of CO2 that's in the atmosphere right now, which is a little bit higher than 400 parts per million, but it's how quickly we got to 400 parts per million from about 100 less than that. So the CO2 has gone up in, you know, 100 year, let's just ballpark it, 100 parts per million in 100 years, something like that. In the previous times that the Earth has emerged from a glacial state, it took orders of magnitude longer time than that to increase the CO2. So we're doing something that there's really no prior analog to, and going back a really long time with some pretty dramatic changes, like, you know, 10 degree changes in and out of these ice ages. Those happened without us and at a much more gradual pace. So what we're doing right now to the Earth system, which involves all of these ecosystems that are part of the carbon cycle, is very unprecedented. And the ability for, you know, ecosystems to adapt is uncertain in terms of the pace of it. It's not just how much things are changing, it's how rapidly things are changing that matters a lot to ecosystems, probably including us.
You'd mentioned one of the big concerns about climate is ensuring that we can kind of get thermometers all over the world, you know, that we can measure data in all these different, you know, sized pixels across the world. How can we look so far back into time and be so certain that about what carbon dioxide levels were in and out of the last couple ice ages?
That's a good question. So that's where we transition from, you know, sort of modern climate where we have observations that humans were around to actually take. When we think back, you know, prior to a couple hundred years ago, we really rely on methods that come out of a branch of this field called paleoclimate. And it is really clever. I'm not a paleoclimatologist, but I'm always really impressed at the ingenuity of that field. So, for example, we can drill into the giant ice sheets that are sitting on Greenland and Antarctica and get a lot of really interesting information, because every year when a new layer of ice, snow, and then eventually ice forms, it traps in the little air bubbles that are like these little air pockets in there, creates these air bubbles, and it pretty much forever traps the air that was there that day. So it's preserving these records, these, you know, records of actual air that was right here at the surface of the Earth a long time ago. So we extract long cores, we call them. We drill these cores out of there, and then we take the air out very carefully and analyze it in chemical laboratories. Also, the seafloor is a sort of archive of information that goes back even further than that. So from seafloor mud sitting on the, you know, sitting at the bottom of the ocean, we can get information going back, you know, 5 million years about things like this, because it's another layer cake. Every time, as time goes on, you've got this material raining down from the surface of the ocean where there's life and there's, you know, tiny photosynthesizing bugs like phytoplankton. So phytoplankton are, like I said, they're just plant bugs living near the surface of the ocean where there's enough sunlight. And when they build their shells out of the material in the ocean, it's like recording information about the chemistry of the ocean. And then eventually they die, they rain down to the bottom of the sea. And so over time, again, we've got like this growing time capsule of information. So it's kind of like the ice cores, except you have to go out in a big ship and drill these cores out of there. And it's like a window into the climate system going back about 5 million years. Without that kind of information, it would be, you know, we would still know there's a problem right now, but I think it would, I think that adds some urgency to the situation when we look back 5 million years and say, wow, what we're doing now just has absolutely no analog to all of that time where there have been some really dramatic changes in the climate, even without people, and they pale in comparison to these changes now in terms of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere.
And that concludes part 2 of 3 of our climate science primer. For our third and final segment, we'll reconvene with Dr. Karnauskas, where he'll talk about some of his work with small island nations and share some of his thoughts on how we can address climate change at large. Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll tune in next time.
You've been listening to Attention Humans, the podcast of the University of Colorado Consortium for Climate Change and Health.
We unpack the human health dimensions of climate change and emphasize the urgent need for all of us to get involved.
We want to thank Dr. Rosemary Rochford and Dr. C.C. Sorensen for their mentorship on this project.
Ellen McFarlane and Matt Cook for technical support.
Cake for the jam and theme music.
Our awesome guests for sharing their expertise.
And you, our listeners, for paying attention.
See you next time.